This episode of A Taste of the Past is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, an employee-owned company that's been making stone ground products for decades. Bob's Red Mill makes it possible to eat healthfully and cook delicious food. Go to bobsredmill.com and use the code TASTEOFTHEPAST for 25% off your order. Something's fishy. Garum, liquamen, muria. But what's in a name? Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history, and today we are going way back. As far back as we can probably piece together any recipes and foods and flavoring agents that we can find. In fact, specifically, we'll be talking first about fish sauces. Now, I'm sure you, unless you've been living under a rock, you are aware of fish sauces in ancient Roman times. In fact, some people say, ooh, that food was so disgusting. They ate all this squishy fermented stuff. Well, we're here to set the record straight, and we will be talking about garum and liquamen and muria, and maybe even relate them to some of what a lot of you may know, the Asian fish sauces that I'm sure you're cooking in some of your Thai foods and Eastern, Southeast Asian foods. The person I have to talk about it with today is Sally Granger. Sally is the foremost expert on Roman fish sauces, specifically garum we'll be talking about. And what a background she has, and we'll find out why she got interested in this smelly stuff. She was a former pastry chef. Ah, just think of those delicate pastries and frostings and icings. And then on to archaeology as an experimental archaeologist, which kind of led her to be a hands-on food historian. And from a food historian, she dove directly into that vat of smelly fish sauce, and I don't think she's come out yet. Sally, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You and Andrew Dalby wrote the classical cookbook, and then you came out with Cooking Apicius right about the same time. And then also you and your partner Chris Grocock wrote the bilingual, which I love. I have two books of the bilingual edition of Apicius. It's the wonderful original Roman cookbook. Well, no, it's how original we don't know, but it's wonderful. Just like reading Dante, you have the original language on one page, and the facing page you have the English translation, and it is a real eye opener for people. But tell me why. Why, with the book that you have, the classical cookbook, which is wonderful, and the recipes are mostly all yours anyway in that book, are they not?
They're the Roman slave cooks, really. I only helped to interpret.
You're just a slave, right? Okay. You were
all,
a slave.
All cooks were slaves.
That's right.
Yes, yes.
So what's different about cooking Apicius?
Well, we started out with Andrew doing the classical cookbook, and I was experimenting with recipes in a modern kitchen. And there's a limit to what you can know with modern equipment, with a gas cooker. And then I started to experiment with authentic equipment, with charcoal and wood. And I, in a sense, stood in the shoes of a Roman slave cook and learnt very slowly over many, many years to cook Roman food as it should have been cooked and to taste it as it would have really tasted. And so once I learnt those skills, I could then go to the text of Apicius and say, we can translate this for a modern audience, but also in a much more accurate way than had previously been translated.
Well, it's interesting because for anyone who has ever looked at an ancient, well, even in, you know, an early Old English or early American recipe for that matter, but an ancient Roman recipe, if you've tried to read some of the books or the cuneiform tablets in Babylonia.
Very difficult to interpret.
They don't tell you a whole lot.
Because they're only talking to each other. The cook is talking to the cook through a recipe.
So they assume
assume all kinds of knowledge. And it's only in the last 400 or 500 years that recipe books have suddenly been had to be expanded in order to appeal and to for ordinary people, i.e. the housewife, to understand.
Take a pan that's 10 inches yes, wide and put exactly. it on the stove. Yeah, it's true. There, you have to go into it knowing your way around the kitchen a bit, mm-hmm. you know.
Sure.
But you've been, you know, it's done. You've, your adaptations of the recipes are excellent.
Thank you so much. That's so good to know. Because sometimes one doesn't always know. I mean, it works for me, but sometimes, you know, when you pass your recipes on, they can fly and they can do strange things. And people will come back to me and say, well, I didn't make that quite the way.
Well, I did make your recipe for the frittata for an event we had the other evening, and I did mention that you didn't say how much fish sauce to use.
Hey, it depends on the saltiness and the umami. Every bottle of fish sauce is a little bit different. This is the magic of it.
So use your taste, right?
Yes.
Well, they always say salt and pepper to taste. So
of course.
Use
yes.
your taste.
Yes.
Well, now you mentioned umami. So let's go there.
So
fish sauce is, for those of you who are wondering, well, why fish sauce? What is it? Well, certainly you've heard of the new taste, the fifth taste, if you will,
taste,
right?
Umami. It's umami. Deliciousness. It's meaty, it's cheesy, it's kind of funky.
I would say earthiness.
Earthy. Earthiness, yeah. You get it from Parmesan, you get it from anchovies, of course. And the issue is that if you don't have umami in your food, it's bland. And so you only really know what it is when it's not there. And then you can taste it and suddenly get that explosion in the mouth. There's a recipe I do quite often called a pear patina. It's a dessert, but it's got fish sauce in it. And it's odd. People get a bit twitchy about it. You take cooked pears, you add raisin wine, a bit of pepper, eggs, and fish sauce. And it's set like a custard. And I make it with salt, I make it with fish sauce, and I make it with nothing. And I offer it to children because they are the ones that are the most honest about their experiences of food. And I say, which is best? And it's always the fish sauce that is chosen because it is exceptionally good. And you can't taste the fish, and it's just got that wonderful balance.
Yeah, it makes the sweet taste sweeter and the mellow custard tastes
exactly.
mellower. Right?
But when I tell them, of course they change their mind.
Right, they turn up their nose.
Because desserts should not have fish in them. Well, they can.
Well, I know that you worked in the British Museum, you've worked a lot of places. Let me list a few of those. The British Museum and some of the rest. You did a lot of the recipes for events there and for the publications.
Yes, because the Classical Cookbook was through the British Museum.
Through the
Press.
British Museum.
Yes.
And then the Fishbourne Palace and the Roman Baths at Bath,
yes.
Colchester Castle.
Yeah.
Not to mention the Getty Villa this side of the pond in L.A., right?
I was food consultant at the Getty for about 5 years. That was fun.
Doing their classical period banquets.
Yeah, we did ancient Greek, we did Roman, and we did Byzantine.
Wow.
And working with their chefs in their kitchen to produce something as authentic as possible while also being appealing to a modern American palate, which is a difficult balance to get.
Well, that's what I always tell people when we do for the culinary historians, when we're cooking recipes that match a particular time period that we're talking about. Mm. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you have to say, well, make it so that someone really wants to eat it. You don't have to be so rigorous to the original that the taste just isn't there.
Well, so many of the recipes don't have quantities.
Right.
And there was an assumption on the part of many scholars who were looking at these recipes initially, and we're talking Latin and Greek academics, who had no real idea about how to cook, never mind how much spice to use. And they would make an assumption about spices. They reflect wealth, they're expensive, therefore you would use a lot, therefore everything would be overspiced, and then you've got added on top the fact that they didn't understand fish sauce, and so imagined it was the result of putrefaction and disgusting. And then, so they defined Roman food in terms of these perceptions. And of course they were wrong. The spices are used with great subtlety, and they're quite delicate. There's a lot of different spices in a sauce, but they're not used in bulk. It's, you know, you're using teaspoons.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you said, they were expensive.
A lot weren't. But what's important about spices in that time period is that they are antibacterial, and you don't need a lot to retard the bacterial growth.
Mm. And so, and that's, again, you have said that the fish sauce brings out, if without the fish sauce, you wouldn't necessarily taste some of those spices.
No, you wouldn't. No. It's there's a Latin word, temperor, and it's in the recipes a lot. And it, in the context of a recipe, it says balance or temper the sauce with fish sauce. And it just means add enough.
Taste it to your taste.
Taste it, yeah. add in due proportion until it tastes right.
Hmm. Smart cooking advice, yeah. Right. Well, when did we first, as a, you know, the historians and cooking people, where did we first learn of garum?
When did we, in the modern world?
In modern world, yeah.
Well, actually there's some continuity of understanding of it right through until the present day, through the Renaissance and into the later periods. Some of the texts that we have today, particularly the Geoponica, which is an agricultural manual from the Byzantine period, wasn't around in the intervening years. And so they didn't have a definitive recipe. And so they were relying on Pliny.
So he made references to...
He talked a lot about it, but he was a little confused. And we can go right to the heart of the problem now with Pliny, because he defines garum as a combination of mackerel viscera and blood by association.
That's blood and guts, people.
blood and guts from mackerel. From later instructions, we know it's left to ferment for a time, and it produces this dark, pungent, very funky taste. And he doesn't talk about the other fish sauce. Now, if that's garum, the other fish sauce is liquamen, and it is basically whole small fish. Little sardine, little anchovy.
Yeah, how are you gonna gut a little anchovy?
No. The guts actually come from either mackerel or tuna.
Mm.
And obviously, tuna is going to be the best because, in a sense, there's a huge amount.
Yeah,
it's quite
big fish.
It's a big fish, a lot of viscera, a lot of blood too. But the other fish sauce is lighter. It's much closer to Thai fish sauce. In all the essentials, it's the same. The only difference, really, is that the Roman recipe that we have in the Geoponica talks about 15% by weight for salt. So basically, it is just fish and salt. While modern fish sauce from Thailand and Vietnam, 25% minimum, sometimes 40, even sometimes 50. So the taste in the Far East is for a very, very salty product.
Mm.
And if you take that salt out, what you actually end up with is so much more umami. it becomes much more magical as an ingredient.
So warning, don't use any other salt if you're cooking that Thai food. Just
rely
on the fish sauce. It's interesting because someone once asked you, well, in the original instructions for making the garum or liquamen, it didn't call for salt. But you said, I loved what you said.
Mm.
You said... Well, they would have added salt because they just knew to do that.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Once again, it's that know your way around the kitchen.
Yes.
You know, if you're preserving some food, saving it, you add salt. Right?
Absolutely, yes. Yes, yeah. It would have gone off. It would have been unpleasant without the salt.
Yeah.
Actually, what happens when you make fish sauce is not fermentation as such. It's enzyme hydrolysis.
More than a lacto. Okay.
Yes, there's some lactobacillus bacteria. I was talking to a scientist last night about this, and he said because of the 15% salt, it's low enough to stop the nasty bacteria that we don't want. But it's high enough that lactobacillus bacteria can thrive. They are quite like salt.
Mm.
And therefore, there is this combination of enzyme breakdown of the muscle tissue to harvest the nutrition in the muscle tissue and convert it into a liquid form that you can use as a liquor. But there is also, at the same time, some fermentation going on, and that is going to increase the pH and help to control the bacteria.
Yeah. So something has to be there to, you know, otherwise...
It's very safe. This is the point.
There's no mold. You never see mold growing in your, you know, in your bottle of fish sauce.
I made quite a lot of fish sauce in a greenhouse in fish tanks.
Oh.
About 50 litres. I made it
in fish tanks. Well, that's smart.
So that you can see what's happening.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about that, what's happening. But first I want to ask you, I'm thinking, how did you first get interested in wanting to study fish sauce further?
Well, I started out as a chef. Then I took my first degree in ancient history. I encountered food historians like Andrew Dolby, who confessed he couldn't cook, he needed help. And then we started work on Apicius. But I realised that I needed to, the things I had to say, I wanted people to hear, as it were, and archaeologists and historians were not hearing it because I wasn't speaking their language. So in order to learn the language of archaeology, I took an MA at Reading University, and you have to do a dissertation. And so what defines Roman, in fact, all ancient food in the Mediterranean basin is the use of fish sauce. Mm-hmm. And I had to choose a topic that I really wanted to get my teeth into. And so I started out on that route. And so we started making it in the first year. I did it over 2 years. So the first summer, I got the fish tanks and the fish and watched it dissolve. And then the following year, we had it all tested. And that was my dissertation. And it's subsequently that 24,000-word document has been published 3 times in 3 separate formats, because I was talking about text, I was talking about amphora, I was talking about fish bones, and I was talking about experimental archaeology.
So you actually have 4 different faculties of study
Yes, exactly, right, yeah. Yes. And it's very hard to get your head around all of those topics.
And you're working on a book eventually will come out of all that, right?
The story of Garum is going to be called, yeah.
If they ever stop discovering new things, I mean...
Well, I wish that, yes, every shipwreck that turns up is complex, because you then have to worry about what fish are what fish bones are inside the amphora in the shipwreck? What shape of amphora? Is there any labels on the amphora written in ink? Sometimes they survive even in the sea.
Could you figure there was oil, there was wine, there was fish sauce?
There are 3 products: oil, wine, and fish sauce. And wherever the Romans went, these things went first, because it's fundamental for a good life to drink the wine. The oil is useful for cooking, but also for light. And the fish sauce makes your food taste good. And in fact, also, not only that, but when these three ingredients are blended together, you make a definitive dressing called an oinogarum, which you put on your salad, your vegetables, you pour it over your food. It is the way in which Roman food was consumed with these sauces. And we're fairly certain that even in the periphery of the Roman world, and my knowledge is only really about Roman Britain, but we're fairly certain that they were doing it there too. We're trying to prove that they did. At the moment, we're doing residue analysis of some of the vessels associated with fish sauce that we find in London, in Roman London, and some of them are worn. Some of the residues can penetrate, and we've been testing it, and we've found evidence of certainly products derived from grape, products derived from vegetable oils, and animal products. We cannot really say it's fish. We can say it's an animal rather than a plant. And so we're testing more and more vessels to try and find out.
So the amphora are important because of the residues. You don't have to make... I mean, the fish sauce, I thought perhaps they were... You know, they were an integral part of the making of fish sauce, and yet I know my daughter-in-law makes hers in an oak barrel.
Yes, whatever vessel you can make it in. But I think in terms of the bulk process of making Spanish fish sauce and North African fish sauce, huge tanks full of tons and tons of fish, as soon as they have dissolved sufficiently to make an emulsion that flows, that is semi-liquid, this can be... I believe this is what happens. It's not easy to prove. It was transferred to an amphora in this thick, gloopy state. Maybe topped up a little with extra brine, sealed, put in a boat, sent off. And in transit, the enzyme activity continues. And by the time it gets, if it's left Cadiz in southern Spain, and it goes across the Mediterranean to Ostia, the port in Rome... I don't know exactly how long a sea journey takes. They don't go straight across because it's too dangerous. Right. They skirt the coast of France. Maybe it sits at the port for a while as well, and they give it a shake occasionally. And eventually all the fish dissolve, the bone sinks to the bottom, you pour out the liquor, the bones stay in the vessel, and the vessel gets thrown away into a ditch and 2,000 years later we find that
vessel. Scrape the bones out of the piece.
We find that vessel with the bones in the bottom. Uh-huh. The sauce comes out as a thick liquor, which when you let it stand for a time, the fish paste floats to the surface. You can scoop it off.
And that's called?
Alec.
Alec.
So it's anchovy paste. Very similar to what's called...
A-L-L-E-C, Alec, right?
Yes. Very similar to what's called pissalat, which is a fish paste that's made in southern France in the Nice area. And there is some sense of continuity in the sense that I think that's been made right through from Roman times to the present.
So what you were saying, that most of the fish sauce was made, obviously had to be a seafaring, fishing ports, but Spain and North Africa? In the empire there?
There are hundreds of fish sauce factories along the Cadiz coast, from Malaga to Cadiz and west of the Straits of
Gibraltar.
Still
today. Are there any other... I find a lot of fish sauces, obviously the Asian fish sauces, in the markets. Is there any commercial product available that it would be more like a liquamen or a garum? Certainly not the garum. We wouldn't have just a blood sauce. You know?
Yeah, no. There are two products that you can get. One is called Coloratura de Alici. This is made in the Bay of Naples. It's not a true garum or a liquamen because they eviscerate the fish. So the enzyme activity that would harvest all that lovely nutrition and umami are not present. It's funky, but it's light, yes. Yeah. It's golden yellow. And it's quite expensive. And sort of, in a sense, I object on principle because they waste so much time eviscerating and they shouldn't bother.
Well, maybe you need to hire yourself out as a consultant,
yes,
you know?
I know. It's such a shame.
And they are really breaking into the market.
They are. It's too expensive for what it is.
Coloratura di Chitara, right?
Alici. Which is
the town of Chitara.
But it's
made from anchovy. Yeah.
Yes, of course. The other product that I would recommend if you want to use a liquamen fish sauce is the Vietnamese fish sauce called Red Boat.
Yeah.
Because it is made with very low levels of salt.
Yeah.
And so it's got a very, very nice umami flavour and it's very high in nutrition. You could survive quite nicely on it. If you've ever made a thick stock and reduced it down to a syrup to freeze in little cubes, and that's really sticky. Well, that's what that fish sauce is like out of the bottle.
Yeah.
So it's so rich.
And you know, it's interesting because not having that type of a sauce was not part of the American diet originally. You know, and nor the British really. But we use a lot of, and you have a similar thing, and for that umami flavor, a Worcestershire sauce.
Of course, which has anchovies.
It has anchovies in it, right?
Yeah, but it's got about 20. 30 other ingredients.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
So it kind of becomes very much more dense.
So fishing was big business. I loved, there was you were asked a question at an event the other night, which I thought was interesting. So because, you just don't see the Romans roaming around making their own fish sauce. It was a big business.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yeah. And I think to a certain extent it was a piggyback business in the sense that the army were controlling the trade in many of these products because they needed it for their soldiers.
Oh, of course.
And so it travels into Gaul, it travels into Germany, it travels into Britain because the army want certain things and so...
They march on their stomachs.
Exactly. So all these products travel north. It's difficult to work out how economically viable it was in terms of modern economics, and that's the problem. We don't really understand how the Roman economy worked because I suspect it actually worked much better than we think simply because they weren't too worried about profit.
Yeah, and they had the dole. I mean, they supported people who
they
needed
did.
To eat.
They supported people who were on a list, and if you weren't on the list, you didn't get supported.
That's true.
So, yes, it was, and that list was quite small. That, you know, the number of people on that dole list were restricted, and there was a constant supply, or slaves were being freed all the time, onto to sink or swim under their own steam. But very often those slaves were trained in a skill, and therefore they could earn a living.
Mm-hmm. What you have described in your book that garum was really more the king of sauces, or the elite sauce.
It was, I think, yes.
Why? Because it's harder to make?
There's a huge problem here because it is made from fish rubbish. And yet, writers like Marshall talked about it being noble and so expensive and so mysterious, and they probably overdo it in their enthusiasm, excuse me, for it. So there's a real problem about how, and I think there's a sense in which some Roman gourmets secretly think they're being conned. But it is interesting as a product. It's a table sauce.
So finishing sauce.
Sauce, and it's black and glossy, and you pour it onto cooked food, and it just adds a real punch of a different kind of umami to the food. I think the Roman gourmet handled the bottle, myself. It's very difficult to prove. It's not there in the texts. We hear, for instance, from Marshall that oysters from Lake Lucrine in the Bay of Naples have arrived, and all they crave is garum sociorum, which is the finest of the garum sauces, which may have been made from mullet blood and viscera rather than either mackerel or tuna. That's the sense we get.
Why do you think that?
It actually is a little snippet of something in Pliny when he, in passing, says Apicius thought it awfully nice to kill, but I think he means cook, mullet in a garum sociorum, in a garum of their allies, in a garum of themselves. So you make a garum sauce, which this is where I'm...
this is one of your proposals. You're positing this.
It's not. We're not sure, because I don't think there's any evidence at all anywhere else for garum sociorum being used as a cooking
as
medium.
As a cooking medium and not as the final sauce.
Exactly.
Huh?
But he says cook or kill in a garum of our allies. And the mullet is therefore being cooked in a garum made from mullet.
Interesting.
But it's one of these little throwaway lines in Pliny, and you just... go, you puzzle.
Yeah. Well, you've talked too about the sauces being like we have today and have forever, but the pressings of oils, the first pressing, second
Absolutely.
Pressing.
Yes.
Well, so what they would, what would they do?
Well, I think for a time, archaeologists assumed that the first liquor to come from the fish tank would be the best, with olive oil in mind, I think, probably. But actually, the longer you leave it, the better it is. And we do have references to fish sauces being stored for up to 2 years. There is reference also to salted fish being stored for 4 years. I do know that when I made my fish sauce, I left some of it unfiltered for quite a long time, and its nutrition doubled from the sauce I extracted from the fish paste. So the longer you leave them together, fish paste and liquor, the enzyme activity continues. The other fish sauce, we've talked about Alec, we've talked about garum and liquam, and the fourth one is muria, and this is the brine that you would store salted fish in, any kind of salted fish, but I think in terms of the bulk of the trade, it's either mackerel or tuna. And this can be aged for 4 years. Now, I would not want to eat tuna that has been sitting in brine for 4 years. I suspect what is happening is that it's the offcuts of the tuna carcass, little bits and pieces, and actually it sits in there and generates a really good quality muria over those years. And it, as it matures, they think it gets better. We hear that salted fish that's old, aged, is quite desirable, but I don't think they mean 4 years. I think they mean 6 months. And so possible that the tuna comes out at some stage and is sold quite cheaply, or it's left in there completely for 4 years. I've salted some tuna for 2 days.
And that was a sauce enough for you.
That was a sauce enough for me, yeah.
Yeah. And then a lot of times the raft, or if you will, the paste that floats to the top, would be if it were still had a lot of other things in it, would be given to slaves. You've mentioned in your book, right?
Yeah, I think what used to happen is the liquor was poured off the bones in a form that flowed. So it came out of the amphora as a liquid. And so the bones stayed in the amphora. All you need to do is put a cloth over the top to stop the bones coming out as you pour.
Right.
Therefore, you have what's called an emulsion, which over time separates out. And then you can take the aleg off the top, and it is relatively bone-free. And I think that was given to the slaves. One of the issues is that there was an assumption aleg must have had bones in it, and the slaves were given it because that's all they were entitled to. Somehow the product must have been a combination of fish bones and fish paste, because they couldn't imagine, the archaeologists couldn't imagine how the bones came out of it. But I wanted to say that it's always a source first, and the source is liquid and it flows. And it's
and
very
the,
easy
and
to...
the dense items would sink,
yeah,
the bones
it's very
would sink.
Easy to extract the bones. And so you don't have to assume that slaves are eating a bony fish paste. And I think it somehow says more about our perception of what slaves would expect than anything about how
the Romans were treating them, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, interesting. Yes, yes. Well, we're going to talk about some of the recipes from your Cooking Apicius book and those that have some garum in them as well.
Yes.
When we come back after a short break, so stay tuned. I'm Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past, and Bob's Red Mill is one of our generous sponsors of programming here at Heritage Radio Network. And you know, I wouldn't actually be endorsing their product if I didn't use it or were a fan of it and believe in it. In fact, Bob's Red Mill almond flour has been a product I've been using for a long time. I used almond flour in a lot of my baking over the years. And I do like Bob's Red Mill. It's, you know, a lot of times you'll get almond flour that has kind of a gritty texture to it. And I think it must be the stone grinding at Bob's that changes the quality of this. It's fluffy. It's actually a softer, fluffier flour. I really like to use it when I make fruit tarts, and we are getting upon that season, because there's just something, rather than grinding up the almonds, using an almond flour makes the crust. What do you want out of a crust? Flaky, all right? You want it a little flakier, you want it lighter, and I love the texture and the flavor that Bob's Red Mill almond flour gives it. I encourage you to go to bobsredmill.com. Check out their whole line of products. You'll be pleased, I guarantee. And don't forget to use Taste of the Past, all one word, Taste of the Past, on your order for 25% off. Hi, we're back, and I'm speaking with Sally Granger. Sally is an authority on Roman fish sauce, garum, and Roman cooking as well, ancient Roman cooking, the cooking of Apicius. In fact, her book, Cooking Apicius, which came out, about 10 years?
2006.
2006. Yeah. A lovely little book, kind of. It also, at the same time, she wrote the Classical Cooking with Andrew Darby. But this book, you explain all the items in the beginning, and then you have recipes that are for the modern kitchen, and it's as though I'm reading a modern day cookbook. Mm-hmm. I mean, things that we might not always eat stuffed kidneys, but
no.
You know, but there are a lot of the omelets and roast pork and wonderful things like that. What to you, are there any recipes that to you are the most say indicative, you feel, of the cooking of the period?
Apart from the sauces that we talked about before,
right.
The oily garum sauces. Otherwise, you have to think about how the Romans dined. They dined lying down. And so they were only using one hand to eat, and they were eating with their fingers. So no matter how elaborate the food might be in terms of roasts, of whole joints and so on, it all gets cut down into little pieces.
They had carvers.
They had carvers, yes. They had specially trained carvers.
Right.
Who worked on wooden models of animal carcasses so they can work out where the best meat was on an antelope or whatever. So it's all, it's little pieces of food in a dish and a little bowl of sauce. So that's how meat is served. Otherwise, you have what's called a patina. This is a frittata. And they're very common.
I think of an omelette, but you're right. Yes. It's more of a frittata because it has so many things in it.
Exactly. It's very dense with fruit, vegetables, meat, fish, with an egg batter. And they can be quite deep too. You can line a deep dish with vine leaves, interlayer multiple different kinds of fish and meat and vegetables, and then pour on the batter, fold over the vine leaves, sit it on top, or actually inside embers of a fire, put a lid on top, and then put the embers on top of that, and the whole thing bakes up like a cake. You then turn it out and peel away the leaves, and you have this, think about 4 or 5 inch deep frittata that cuts like a cake that you can pick up. And there are a number of recipes like that in Apicius, and I've had a go at making them on an authentic charcoal fire. And it's complex because you can't really get... It's very hard to get the egg in the middle to set. But I think I've done it once.
Huh.
And made it work.
Yeah.
So they were very, very common. And, of course, once set and actually lost some of their heat, it's cut up and it's perfect.
They firm up more.
For picking up. Yeah. Yeah. In the hands.
As we always say, frittata is good picnic food.
It's great.
Serve it the next day.
There's lots of reheated pork. And the story is, I think, that they're serving at important banquets where they have special guests, whole roast pig. And it actually goes back in the kitchen. It's not left there for people to pick at. The cooks are carving it off and are storing it overnight and are reheating it the next day.
Saying, hey, we can get a couple more meals out of this guy.
Right? I mean, obviously, the household slaves are being fed too, but... Yeah. That sauce that is then made with this reheated pork is more spicy than normal. And, of course, that's sensible because you're then making sure that it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a 20 or 30 recipes like that. Take a roasted shoulder of pork, it says, and turn it into a sauce.
And did they eat stuffed dormice? Yes, of course.
Well, they did. And I have never been able to, sadly, because every dormouse that I've ever had access to, and I have had a few... has been poisoned because it's been killed by rat poisoning because they are a protected species. So if I ever confess that I would like to, people get very shocked and disturbed. So yes. I don't tell anybody.
Open your minds, people. Come on.
Yes. Right. Yes.
And as far as a lot of the herbs, let's talk about some of the herbs and spices that were commonly used there that maybe we all know about now, but some we don't.
Yes. Yeah. Well, cumin and coriander are the dominant spices. So basically, we're looking at curry.
Mm-hmm.
Sweet and sour curry. There's a lot of oil, wine, vinegar, fish.
She says with a smug British look on her face.
Yes, I know. but a Malaysian curry, I think of, because they are much sweeter. But the other spices, I mean, pepper is the most important one, I think. It's the most desirable one. It came from India. It was very expensive, but only in terms of relative value. Ordinary people aspired to it and had access to it, because every family, no matter how poor, actually has a rite of passage feast where they have pepper. We get that from text. And we find pepper, we know pepper was found in Roman Britain associated with the soldiers, so it filters down. It's not just for the elite. But the other spice that's most interesting, and it's also quite pungent in the same way as fish sauces, is something called silphium. It had a reputation for being a cure-all, an aphrodisiac and a soporific. It can't be both. It's got a sort of a rotten garlic, fermented garlicky taste. It's a resin. It came initially from Cyrenaica in northern Libya, but finally died out. I think we hear from Pliny that the last stalk of the plant was given to Nero.
Yeah, they lamented the fact that there was no more silphium.
There was no more silphium.
Yeah.
But it's an exquisite flavour when it's roasted, just like garlic. If you've never had garlic before and you taste it for the first time, you will probably wince. But if you roast this resin and put it with a chicken and some wine and a bit of fish sauce, it is heavenly.
Now, asafoetida has been known to sort of substitute for it, but...
Quite early on, in fact.
Really?
So asafoetida, as in the substitute for silphium, was in the market parallel with silphium probably for the last 100 years before Pliny notes its demise.
Mm.
Because in Apicius, we have a recipe which actually says if you have either use Cyrenaica or Parthian silphium. They still called the Isopotida from up from Parthia silphium.
Oh, interesting.
So it was considered to be sufficiently similar.
Well, and it's still a popular ingredient in Indian cooking.
Oh,
a lot of
Yes. Yeah. I have some friends who have family in Kabul in Afghanistan, which is where it's now grown. And I get on every 2 or 3 years, I get a little packet of freshly harvested Isopotida from the plant. It's still wet.
Oh, interesting.
Which the Romans would never
have
had.
No, we only see the powdered, the powdered stuff
the
at this
place. The smell and taste of the fresh, wet resin is just amazing.
Now, as far as the herbs, they used a lot of savory, of course.
And, savory, coriander, parsley, thyme.
Lovage was very important.
Not a herb, it's a spice.
Interesting. I grow it in my garden, and it looks like an herb to me.
Yeah, no. It's the seed. It's the seed.
They use the seeds. Oh.
Yeah, it's funny. Every single recipe that calls for lovage lists the lovage at the beginning with the pepper and then lists other spices before it goes on to herbs.
So
and
then you you surmise that they were using the
Yeah,
the
and
seed
in fact there is a list of spices and ingredients that you need to keep in your kitchen if you want to be a good cook that comes in a much later late Latin sauce. And there is a name. These are your condiments. These are your spices. These are your herbs, and it comes under seeds.
Under spices. Interesting.
It's quite a bitter spice.
Yeah. I mean, the leaves are like celery and the stalks, but it's got it has that aftertaste.
Yeah.
Rue. Now, rue is something that people think, that you can't get it.
Panic. There's a panic over rue. Yes.
I have a beautiful plant in my garden upstate in my country house, and not only do I have one, but it is self-seeding.
Yeah, really?
And
that's
now all of a sudden I have like five different plants. I'm giving them away, and they grow in between the stones.
Yes.
But it is, that was used. I mean, we don't find rue well because there are some problems with it.
Yes. I mean, if you use a large quantity of it in a tea, it's dangerous to consume it. But on a tiny, in small amounts, it adds another kind of bitterness, and bitter is good.
Mm-hmm.
Salt, sweet, sour, and bitter. You want all three, all four, to have, a satisfying taste in the mouth. And so I'm always very careful with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a huge plant in my garden, and I've shared it with a number of people over the years.
Yeah. Well, beautiful thing is it's perennial, and it gets more beautiful every
year. It's very pretty as well. And the seed heads, too, are used.
Yes.
Yeah. You just have to be careful with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then I'll remember that. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They always said rue was always known to be poisonous.
Yes. If you pick it in full sunlight and you have sensitive skin, I have seen somebody come out in enormous blisters.
Really?
Yes, really quite ugly blisters. So you just, if you are prone to being sensitive,
pick it in the shade.
Pick it in the shade.
Okay. That's good. What? Tell me about like orders of the dishes of some of the recipes. Would there be certain things as we would know as appetizer, main course?
I think the Romans actually invented the concept of the three-course meal, with the little appetizers to stimulate the palate at the beginning, and then the main roasts and the whole fishes at the end, in the middle, and at the end you have more often savouries than desserts. And in fact, desserts...
Savouries such as...
Well, stuffed dormice are served as a final course.
And for dessert we have stuffed dormice.
But often it's just fruit and nuts and cheese and olives and things like that. And there's a phrase, soup to nuts. Yeah, you start with soup, you end with nuts. That actually works with the Romans because nuts come in at the end. And it's eggs to nuts in the Roman world, because you would have a soft boiled egg with a sauce.
Mm, always the sauce. Don't forget the sauce.
Right, exactly.
Right. And the sweets. There were a lot of sweets, but they were incorporated often with the meats or the savories. Were they not? Like, I'm thinking dates and
lots of sauces were very rich and thick with fruits.
Yeah,
dates and figs. The actual dessert recipes that we had that survive are quite small in number. There were a number of bakery books that were written that we hear about, but they don't survive, sadly. Mm. So in Apicius, for instance, there's about 8 recipes for pudding, as we call it. One of which is for a custard, which is basically the recipe for creme caramel.
With honey
instead of caramelized sugar.
And they would use a lot of date honey as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And something called difrutum. Difrutum is fresh grape juice reduced down to a syrup very slowly, sometimes in a lead pan, which is a little unfortunate, but we don't do that. And you can add figs or dates to it. And it becomes very thick and rich, and it's called colouring. So they used it to add colour to sauces. Now, difrutum was left in oak barrels, and it soured. And hey presto, you have balsamic. That's how balsamic was born.
Aha! That's a whole other topic in itself. Mm-hmm. And we could go on for hours about balsamic vinegar.
Yes.
Indeed. Sally, it is a pleasure to hear. I mean, we could just go on talking, and you're a font of everything Roman, for sure. And I look forward to one of these days when the work is complete.
Oh, yes.
You know, having that book. Well, you mentioned something that I think is very interesting, that people are studying fish sauces around the world, but you don't talk to one another.
No. Well, the archaeologists that study the fish bones, and the archaeologists that study the amphora, and the archaeologists who study the fish processing tanks, the shipwrecks, and then the classicists who deal with the texts, and modern manufacturers of fish sauce, people like me who do experimental archaeology, we need to actually conduct multidisciplinary research together. And that's not really happened yet. I think we're getting there. There will be a time, I think, when it'll be a fully integrated research.
Well, certainly food and cultural history has come up in the world as being more important than rather than just the material culture itself.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I look forward to that day. I think it'll be wonderful, and I wait to hear from it. Thank you for listening. My guest again has been Sally Granger, and her recent book on Roman recipes, if you're interested in trying to cook Roman, is Cooking Apicius. I think it's still available.
It's still
in print.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Terrific. Okay. And this has been another Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.